Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Having like time warps, we're so far ahead now. I mean, or not really, but you know, it's like, holy shit, crazy. And now it's going to get nuts, dude. It's a cultural shifts around here, for God's sakes. I'm Dan Nalen, and you have tuned in to Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and it's one of the oldest independent publications in the U.S., distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action, sports, and subculture available anyplace cool, and of course, always online. In this episode, we talk to the good people at Spock Skate Camp, we talk to the band Cult Leader, and we talk to local filmmaker Kenny Riches about the lost films of David Fetzer. Talk about a fine way to spend a little bit of your summer time. Spock Skate Camp is a traveling skateboarding camp based right here on the Wasatch Front that travels around to smaller areas like Kearns, American Fork, Sandy, up to Layton, those kind of places, to teach kids the fundamentals of skateboarding. The camp promotes safety and skateboard etiquette, as well as building up social skills and making new friends for the kids, all while getting outdoors a little bit and learning a new skill. Slug writer Billy Ditzig sat down with Spock himself to talk about the camp and the work that they do.
You've been skating since you were 13?
Actually 11. Like, my first skateboard was the real yellow banana. I think we got that at like a, whatever the equivalent was of a Walmart back then, you know, in Fairfield, California, to be exact. It's about an hour north of San Francisco and an hour, 40 minutes south of Sacramento. My brother, he had a Black Knight skateboard. Then I got one, and we lived in a rural area, so the pavement was, it sucked. It was horrible. And then we moved, my mom died, and we moved into Fairfield, which is a suburban town, right next to Travis Air Force Base. It was all paved. Everything was paved and smooth. And that first day that we moved in, I grabbed my skateboard and started skating around. And I was just blown away. I could just carve down the streets and go fast with these loose ball bearings, you know, and urethane wheels and this plastic yellow banana. And it was fantastic. And then, I met some kids in the neighborhood, and this Ray Izagirre told me about this guy, Chris Obiokoro, who had like a real skateboard, and he had Real Skateboarder magazine, and he went to the same elementary school. He said, yeah, my dad will take us to the skate park. It's in Alameda. But before that, we got real skateboards for, we all got like real skateboards for Christmas. And we went to this place, and it was incredible. There were these like snake runs down to these bowls, the beginner bowl, the intermediate bowl, the pro bowl. It was a gas. It was so fun, you know, to be doing that. And that had to be like 1977. So that's where it all started. That's how my skateboarding roots started coming in.
So around that time, what were your goals? Did you want to be a pro skateboarder? Or did you just want to pursue it for fun? Or were you looking for a career down the line through it? Or
we just wanted to have fun. Our goal was to get higher on the wall. Our goal was to grind. Our goal was to carve. Our goal was to do 360s, to do a nose wheelie, to do anything that was in the magazines, you know. Across the street from my house was, and this is really bizarre, was a Mormon church. And they had the smoothest concrete there. And there was a wheelchair ramp up into the entrance, and we would work on kick turns and power slides and laybacks and burts and just anything that we saw in the magazine, because that's what we were just trying to emulate. And then we met some kids, older kids in town, and that's when it all changed for us. That's where the whole game changed. They took us on New Year's morning 1978 to our first backyard pool, and that was incredible. It was the most eye-opening experience. These guys were grinding the deep end, grinding the shallow end, and we had just been riding, like, we built our own ramps that were all not even smooth transition. It was just 4x8s connected, clank, 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 with a piece of a broom handle nailed in for coping. And so we're riding this pool trying to do kick turns on the wall like we would do on the ramps. And they were like, no, you gotta learn how to carve. you got to learn how to ride the transition around this bowl. And then they took us to the glory hole, 30-foot pipe, a full pipe in Lake Berryessa, which was only about a half hour from where we lived. And that's where we learned how to fakie. That was the first place I learned how to fakie. I was only getting up to like maybe 5 o'clock on kick turns, you know? But this thing's massive, 30 foot. And we'd go back there every year, maybe a few times a year. And that place is just kind of like a mecca to go to. You know, I went there last year, just had the greatest time. You got to take a raft over to it and stuff.
So they're still there?
Oh, it's still there. Yeah. That's not going anywhere. That was built by the Army Corps of Engineers in 1940-something, 1930s, who knows when. Yeah, that place is mind-boggling, you know?
Does it cost to join Spock's Cave Camp?
It does. You know, it's I got it pretty much right now to where it's about $60 or $65 for 8 hours of instruction. And that is once a week, 2 hours in the mornings for 4 weeks. So that'd be like a session one, and then there's a session two, like June, and then July, and then a shorter one in August. So that's about the roundabout of what it is.
What kind of age groups do you have?
We ask for the kids to be 6 to 14 years old. However, I will take kids that are younger than that if they know how to push, stand, and roll. And I've had some four-year-olds that have been incredible. Oh my God, these kids are like, they just go for it. They're so tiny. They got these huge pads on their knees and their helmets. They're so cute. And they're like, some of them are grinding, dropping in. They're awesome. Like, you're 4 years old, what are you doing, man? Oh my God. And they'll take a spill, they get back up, shake it off, and just keep going, you know?
Wow.
It's a cool thing to see.
Are there any other requirements to joining the camp?
Gotta have a helmet. That's about it. We have girls, we have boys. You gotta wanna be there. And usually, and for the most part, they are, you know? It's not like a, my mom said I had to take this sport class. I had to do this. I don't want to be here. I've had one kid like that in 10 years now. And I tried to turn him around, and it just didn't work. But, you know, that's okay, because the sport isn't for everybody. It's not, you know. But the requirement, no, just a lust for life and want to have some fun, you know. And that's not much of a requirement. It's something that's in you, I think.
Where do you offer your camps at?
I'm just going to run through the list here because it's easier that way. On Mondays, we are in Kearns. On Tuesdays, we are in American Fork. On Wednesdays, we are in Layton. On Thursdays, we are in South Jordan. On Fridays, we are in Sandy. And on Saturdays, we are in Cottonwood Heights at the Guthrie Skate Park.
So you skate 6 days a week then?
6 days a week. And then usually Sundays are kind of like recuperating days.
I can't even believe your wife lets you skate 6 days a week.
But usually what happens is on Sundays are the private lesson days. I like to do those close to the house, either at the Jordan River Park, the 9th and 9th Park, as we like to call it, right? Or over at the Fairmont Park.
Do you have a lot of volunteers that come and help you with your lessons?
Yes. Yeah, well, I have people volunteer throughout the years, but I like to take care of my people. I don't want them doing stuff for free, you know. It's like I like them to get a little piece of the pie, you know. I try and take care of them. So yeah, they're employees, but yeah, I guess we can technically call them that. And I do have a good group of those. I find these people through my other job in the wintertime up at Brighton.
Yeah.
I'm the assistant director at the ski and snowboard school. So up there, we train them to work with kids and adults and learn about progression style of teaching. One step leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. And it's much easier to make that transition into skateboarding. If I find out you're a skater and you're a snowboard instructor, I'm talking to you. Say, hey, you want to teach some skateboarding this summer because you're going to be perfect for this because you already know how to communicate with the kids and how to make things fun and how to have their skating improve.
Was it tough getting your name out there as far as a new skateboard camp or getting kids to join at first?
Cooperation of the park and rec departments is phenomenal. There's no way that we could be doing this without them. For logistic reasons, they cover the release forms for the kids. For me to come up with some insurance for the kids would have been a deal breaker. I couldn't do that. You know, I got to come up with insurance for myself and my instructors. I got them covered. But the kids, it's such a liability, you know. So to have them on board to doing that part of the logistic part, as well as taking the money and the registrations and getting the class list together and setting all that up, having the parks closed for the kids, for the camp that morning, it has to be like that because it's much safer. And the parents love that. The kids are in a protected area doing a high-risk sport, and they are really good about getting flyers out to the schools and letting the kids know about it that way. What's been tough is finding kids and connecting with parents outside of that realm. I've tried numerous different types of ways to do it, and sometimes it's paid off and sometimes it hasn't. We do about 300 to 350 kids a summer. Granted, a lot of those kids are repeat clients or participants. So to say tough is, I've never really thought of it that way because it's also a labor of love. This is something that I want to give back to the kids, to the community. I want skating to keep growing. When you love it, I guess it isn't that tough.
How's the camp doing now?
You know, just like in any kind of business or any kind of venture, if you can make it to 10 years, something's going good. And each year, everything had been going up and up and up. Enrollment was going up and up and up. And I'm a realist. I know that somewhere I gotta hit the ceiling, you know? And that kind of happened last year. The numbers dropped a little bit, but I think it's because we didn't have as many beginners coming in. And we had a lot of the return kids filling that upper level section of it. So this year, what I decided to do was, since it was a 10-year anniversary, we did 3 free skate lesson days to bring in some new blood, some new skaters, to show some parents and some kids what we do that maybe had not heard about it before. And of course, you know, we go through the normal channels of sending out emails to all of the newspapers, trying to get the word out there as much as possible, contacting the television stations and whatnot and see who's interested. One of the fun times, was it 2 years ago, when Big Buddha came out and did the skateboard camp with us, and that was gas. That was a really good time. And he got on the skateboard and was skating around and stuff, and that was way cool. He was a very nice man. That was a great day.
What do you see in the future for Spock Skate Camp?
More kids, more people picking up the sport that have never done it before. Bringing their SpongeBob and their Spider-Man skateboards to the camp, and then me saying, this is great, I'll work on their board for a minute and say, hey, do you mind if we just set this to the side? I'd like you to try one of my skateboards, because I got about 10 skateboards that I'll share with the kids, and they can borrow anytime they get, especially if they're first come, first serve. When I'm out of the skateboards, then you maybe have to ride the SpongeBob board. Bringing them in and letting them experience what it's like to be on an actual real tool, but something that's gonna be easy to ride, something that's gonna
work more with you than against you.
Correct. Something that's going to inspire them and go, this is cool, this thing rolls, I'm having fun.
To get more information about Spock Skate Camp, including the exact locations where they're visiting and when, visit them online at SpocksSkateCamp.com. You don't find a lot of punk bands that have lasted 10 years, let alone local punk bands, but the Insurgency are just one of those bands. They formed a good decade ago, comprised of longtime rockers Doug Walker, Jeff Kilpatrick, Jason Heckenibble, and Fred Jenkins. They released their second album, 12-12-12, back in, you guessed it, December of 2012, and I would hazard a guess it probably came out on December 12th. We're going to play a song called One to the Head from that 12-12-12 album. Insurgency will be headlining Slug Localized this Saturday, June 15th at the Urban Lounge, playing alongside Hectic Hobo and the Red on Black. The show starts at 10 p.m. and it's just $5. For more information about the band, be sure to check out our Localized article in the June 2013 issue, currently found anyplace cool or online at slugmag.com, or visit the band online by looking for the Insurgency on Facebook. Cult Leader are a hardcore band from right here in Salt Lake City, a brand new band as a matter of fact, comprised of former Gaza members Anthony Lucero, Casey Hansen, and Mike Mason, as well as Sam Richards. Slug writer Ricky Vigil sat down with the band in the Soundwave studio to talk about their brand new inception.
Tell me about the lineup of Cult Leader.
It's myself, Casey is staying on drums, Mike's staying on guitar. But we brought in Sam Richards from Ryle and Reviver to play bass. And then I'm just giving vocals a shot. So no instrument for me or anything. I'm just going straight vocals.
How has that been? Has it been intimidating or challenging?
It's very challenging. I mean, like I did it in bands when I was like 17, 18. I was just the vocalist. It's very challenging. I'm not intimidated. I'm not scared to do it. I'm more nervous that it's not like second nature. Like playing guitar or playing bass is second nature. So that's like just the biggest challenge I think so far is like, you know, I've got to like build up the natural feeling of it. So, I mean, it's good. And I think I'm going to do okay if I don't hyperventilate.
Yeah.
Like just like pass out. Like, I mean, a lot of that is just like training on being able to do it for a half hour at a time.
So why did you decide to move to vocals?
We needed a vocalist. And we wanted to keep it as insular as possible. I think if we could have stayed a three-piece in some way, we probably would have. But it just didn't feel like what we wanted to come out with wasn't going to lend itself to anything like that. You know, and I know that I'm capable of doing it, at least. And I like doing vocals, and I liked doing it, you know, back in the day. Just kind of, like, volunteered myself to, you know, to give it a shot. The band didn't sign off on it right away, either. It was just, like, we talked about it for a long time. We talked about, like, a lot of other options of other people or other things. And it's just kind of like, this is the way that it's landed. We just like the feel of like a vocalist that can run around.
Yeah, you know? Not be anchored by an instrument.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and there are bands that can do it and are totally fine and are just as intriguing and just as powerful. But it's not necessarily just like the feeling we wanted, so.
Yeah. How would you describe your vocal style?
I don't know. I'm honestly still like figuring out, you know, like what's most comfortable. Just ranges and, you know, things that where I sit most. I mean, it's definitely pretty, I mean, I can do like the higher register stuff, but I think naturally it's a pretty low. I'm doing my best to stay away from like anything that's like quote unquote metal.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like do like Corpse Grinder vocals or anything like that. I'm just going to keep it pissed. I don't know. Whatever. As angry as I can be.
That's a good way to define any kind of sound. So the band still doesn't have any music online or anything anywhere. This show with Full of Hell is going to be the first show. How would you describe your music? I mean, I know a lot of people have expectations of maybe what it might sound like.
It's the core, you know, the core guys that were writing music before this are the ones that are writing music in this. But it's definitely feels different. And I think we've opened ourselves up a lot to ideas that we didn't feel comfortable exploring in the past.
Yeah.
I think these songs so far are a lot shorter and a lot more focused. Like, I mean, it's hard to say that we want to, or, you know, like people to believe or whatever, that we want to be more intense and more pissed than our last band, but it's what we want to do. You know, we really want it to be more pointed, just straight to the point, and shorter songs. We've opened ourselves up to like more punk parts. We'll never be a DB band or anything like that, but we've been able to like fully explore that, because we never felt like that we could explore that idea very much previously, but now, you know, it's kind of wide open. So we're still figuring a lot of things out, you know, like, I don't know if we have a specific feel yet as a band, but I know that we are all on the same page when it comes to creating music, so hopefully that's what comes across.
So what's the songwriting process like? I mean, I'm sure it's a bit different with you handling vocals and I assume lyrics too.
Yeah, so far it's been, the last record we did was, you know, I stepped up. Like, I hadn't been writing very much previously, but then for the last record, I stepped up and I wrote, I think it was pretty solid 50-50 on guitar. So I wrote like half and Mike wrote half. And what we came out, you know, when we came together and put it all, you know, through the mix, filter everything through Casey, because once he starts playing, you know, it's a completely different animal. We've continued that, so we're like, it's both Mike and I writing on guitar stuff. And then once we have a song that's pretty well structured, and then I'll kind of put down the guitar and let Mike just go from there, and then start working out like vocal shit for it.
So what are some of the lyrical themes that you've been working on?
I get really angry with other bands, like heavy bands who, I don't know, it's a weird thing. I was bitching about it earlier, though. I don't think that a lot of heavy bands take what they do seriously enough. Of course, you can have a sense of humor about doing things, but I feel that heavy music, to me personally, is really only structured to convey anger or sadness. You know, like there's a certain amount of like hope that can be involved in the feeling of everything, but I mean, it's fucking pissed music for a reason, and you're screaming not because you want to sing about drinking beer. Mm-hmm. To me personally, yeah. It's because I'm fucking angry or that I'm fucking sad. So like, that's pretty much the core. Like, I don't have a political agenda, and I don't. If I do, I mean, I'll say something, but that's totally not where I'm coming from. It's got to feel really personal to me. Just the things that I'm upset about, I have been writing about so far. And it's become like a really good cathartic way to get shit off my chest. And that's my very favorite thing about like being able to do vocals. I mean, I just keep coming back to being just pissed.
Yeah.
It's angry. It's angry music for a reason. You know, so like when you do shit, like kind of undercuts that. It always upsets me. It's heavy because the subject matter is heavy. It doesn't matter if it's political or emotional or whatever, but that's the heart of it.
So the name Cult Leader it's kind of provocative. I think it's a pretty good angry band name. How did you guys decide on that?
We had been working on, before we even announced like the breakup of the last band, we were trying to figure out what we were going to call this new project. And so much of it just had to do like to being able to like, kind of capture the feeling again. Like, it's all about feeling. I mean, we had chosen maybe like 3 or 4 other names that we were kind of solid on, you know, for like some of them we were solid on for a day, some of them we were solid on. We almost even went with another one. Either like it was already taken, like choosing a band name is actually, I think, the hardest thing about being in a band. Like being able to find one that fits your sound and or fits the feeling that you want and isn't taken in some form where you just like, you have to add an S or an er at the end of it, you know. It almost just comes down to like what's available to a certain extent. And we had a friend actually suggested this one. And when I heard it, it just like all kinds of bells went off for me. It just on what I could do, you know, like artistically, like what directions it could lead me in with all those kind of things. I'm not even really interested in using like cult leader imagery, you know. I don't care about that. Like, I mean, I'm sure some of that will probably sneak in from here and there, but like it's just the actual idea of that type of, like, just almost just that type of person in general that like sets me off in a whole other direction, or like what someone like that can do to other people, or you know, just ideas like that. So I'm really stoked on it. Some of us were more resident to like to go with it, but I mean, it just kind of, you know, necessity and the fact that it doesn't suck, you know, in our opinion, and it's available. I think that it's artistically open is pretty important. So that's kind of basically how we landed on it.
You've been saying that you guys are still trying to figure out the sound and stuff, but do you guys have any plans in the anytime in the near future to record or to tour? Kind of, what's the plan for Cult Leader right now?
The plan is to go at it as hard as we possibly can. You know, I think we've got if we keep writing for another couple months, like 2-3 months, I think we would have enough material for a full length. And at that point, it just, like, whatever we have is what we have, you know. I mean, it's not like we're gonna say that, you know, like, scrap songs, like, those don't go in the right direction, you know. Like, this being, you know, such a new thing that it might come across as kind of scatterbrained or whatever, but that's okay. I mean, like, if we feel that we're open to the direction that we're gonna head in, then we're gonna head in it. We've got, you know, a healthy amount of songs. We've definitely got a full set's worth of material to play, you know, so when we play the show, it'll be a full set. You know, we're not gonna just get out there for 5 minutes and walk off stage, which I'm okay with if we had to do that.
Yeah.
But I think we've been working really hard, but it's been coming really easy, which is nice. Recording, it's just kind of a matter of as soon as we can work it out to record, we'll record. So I think we're happy with what we've got. But we don't know if we're gonna demo things and then send them out to friends and see if, you know, we can get someone that wants to put it out for us, or if we're gonna put it out ourselves. You know, it's just kind of something recorded and then see the best option that can move us forward the quickest, because that's really all we want. So touring is totally not, like, on the table, and we, like, at just as hard as we had been or harder. We're not done. That's, like, the main thing. I think that's another reason that we've written so fast and we're ready. We're just moving so hard to do this. It's like, none of us are done by any stretch of the imagination, and so we want to keep going farther and harder and faster.
This first show is with Full of Hell, who you guys toured with for a while. Mm-hmm. How does it feel to not just have a show lined up after not playing for a while, but to be playing with those guys too?
It feels awesome, and Full of Hell is honestly, like, one of my very, very favorite live bands. Like,
yeah.
They're so fucking good, and they're so heavy, and, like, just their feeling live that they put out is so intense. So on that level, I wouldn't say I'm not intimidated, or any of us would be intimidated, but we are all very not slack in any way whatsoever. Like, I mean, it's a weird thing to have something to prove, but I think that I don't like that idea, but I think we know we're capable, and Full of Hell are our friends, and I know they're a fucking amazing band, and so it's, we want to be able to, you know, be on that level, you know, as soon as possible. And can never say what's going to happen. It'll be the very first time we've ever played out. Probably the very first time that we've ever played on, like, our full set of equipment. You know, so right now we're just using, you know, borrowed stuff to practice on and things like that. So it'll be a strange experience, but I'm stoked for it. And I'm stoked that it's with them, that it gets to be with friends, that we do it for the first time. And a band that I respect. And so I'm excited about it. I think it'd be cool.
Cult Leader will be opening up for Full of Hell on Thursday, June 13th at the Shred Shed, playing along with Seven Sisters of Sleep and Ryle. The show starts at 7 p.m. and tickets are a mere $10. They're so new they don't even have a website, so be sure to check out that show and keep your ear to the ground for more info on Cult Leader. This is your weekly daily calendar for the week beginning on June 11th. As always, you want to be sure to go to slugmag.com every damn day. Check out the new listings that are going up there. There's always something going on around town. And we are deep into the summer now. There is so much going on. It's unbelievable. As always, you can put your own events on there for free or for a mere $5 a month or $50 a year. Add some quality content to your listings. On Wednesday, the 12th of June, Rogue Wave, a band that a few years ago looked on the verge to be blowing up. They're sort of an alt-rock, pop-rock band. I really liked them quite a bit. Then they signed to Dave Matthews' record label. That was when you thought something might go really big for them. Didn't seem to happen, actually. They're playing at the Urban Lounge. Still a fine band. It'll be great to hear them again. Friday, the 14th of June, an unbelievable show. So excited about this. John Spencer Blues Explosion. For anyone who has never seen these guys, one of the best live shows you're going to see all summer long. So excited to have them coming back around through town. The same night, over at the Stateroom, Rachel Yamagata, longtime favorite. She actually has family here in the area. Does a lot of really cool pop rock stuff, piano stuff, guitar, you name it. Always a fine show. Seen her quite a few times, everywhere from Liquid Joe's to the Stateroom. So a nice option if you can't get into that John Spencer Blues show. Saturday the 15th at Slug Localized with Hectic Hobo, The Insurgency, and The Red on Black at Urban Lounge. Be sure to pick up the current June issue of Slug. Read all about those guys. Check it out online, whatever works. You'll want to get to that show, a mere $5. The same night, in an inexplicably good show for the Sandy City Amphitheater, it's Bluegrass Queen Rhonda Vincent. This woman is one of the most badass mandolin players I have ever seen. I've seen her a few times. Sandy City's doing some local stuff this year as well. They have a Hang Time King Nico show booked out there. They're really kind of expanding the repertoire, so maybe that's part of this. A great show to go and sit outside for sure, seeing Rhonda Vincent. She is badass. Sunday the 16th of June, I know a lot of folks will be heading up to see Grace Potter and the Nocturnals at Red Butte, doing that sort of modern classic rock thing they do so well. She's a great front woman for sure. Monday the 17th of June, Bad Veins, the project of Cincy indie pop kid Benjamin Davis. They make some great records. Haven't been around in a few years. Really excited to see them again. And, of course, all you people, Craft Lake City vendor and performer application deadline fast approaching, so get your shit together and get that in. That's your weekly daily calendar. As always, tune in at slugmag.com every day for updated listings and to find something for you to do this very night. For the uninitiated out there, Hectic Hobo are a damn fine gypsy folk rock band based right here in Salt Lake City. They originally formed in March of 2009 with a rotating cast of members, and that continues. Lots of people swapping instruments and hollering and hooping. It's a great old time. Their debut album was called Preachers, Paupers, and Pimps, and that came out in October 2010. And last year they released their sophomore album called We Lost Our Legs in the War, We Just Can't Remember Which War. This is a song called Wally, Buster, Sean, and Me from Hectic Hobo. On my head, go easy on my head.
got you up and down. You'll never beat another soul, but at least you're not underground. Now I think I'll leave this town. I'll keep your money for my troubles and shots pissed for myself. You tell your friend why he got to say open hell.
Hectic Hobo will be playing the Slug Localized show this Saturday, June 15th at the Urban Lounge, along with the Insurgency and the Red on Black. The show starts at 10 and it's just $5. For more information on the band, check out the Localized article in the current issue of Slug Magazine or visit them online at facebook.com/hectichobo. Many of us Salt Lakers know Kenny Riches for his illustrations or perhaps for being the founder of the KO Gallery. He's also an accomplished film director. Most recently, he made a full-length film called Must Come Down that is definitely a must-see. In December of 2012, David Fetzer, a local musician and actor who was the co-lead of Riches' film, passed away, leaving behind a whole lot of unreleased work. It was really one of the saddest stories of 2012 here in Salt Lake. This spring, Riches launched a Kickstarter campaign to help fund a release of Fetzer's unreleased works, including film scripts and music. Slug writer Cody Kirkland talked with Riches on the phone about the effort.
Kenny, can you tell us about David and his role in your film, Must Come Down?
Yeah, David was one of my closest friends, and I guess when I was conceiving the ideas for the film, you know, I kind of wrote it around David. So a lot of the little idiosyncrasies in the film with his character are very much, you know, David things. Like, he can't pee when there's someone standing next to him, that kind of thing. And so it made it a lot easier to not only write, but also direct, because, you know, I could just say, David, be David, go.
He was kind of a natural for the role because it was basically written for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
David, a Salt Lake City native and local actor and musician whose shoes can't be filled, had many unfinished film projects. Tell us about your recent Kickstarter campaign, which raised funds to help bring David's screenplays to life.
After all of the craziness in Salt Lake with the funeral and everything like that, you know, we were all pretty devastated. And, I mean, not even just, like, you know, closest circle of friends, but kind of everyone in Salt Lake really was really devastated. What, even if, you know, they had met him only once or seen him in a play or anything like that, you know, what all it takes with David is just meeting him once to fall in love with him. And so, you know, I thought doing this project would be a good way to, I don't know, carry on his legacy. And I have, you know, a bunch of short film screenplays that we wrote back when we were roommates, and so I thought, you know, might as well try to make some of them into films.
How many screenplays did David leave behind?
I don't know if I've ever actually, like, counted them. That's a good question. Maybe, I don't know. It's not a huge stack, but, you know, it's a stack. Maybe, yeah, 10 or so.
Wow. What drives you to finish his films?
As the project carries forward, it's becoming different things, you know? I mean, originally it was, you know, when I was in Salt Lake, I just kind of discovered them, and so it was, or I guess rediscovered them, and it was really amazing to read some of his work because, you know, he's always been so brilliant, and his writing is so on point, and I don't know. I mean, everyone that's read anything he's written knows that, you know, he is just an amazing writer. And, I guess I wanted to just pay tribute to him that way. But then as we started, you know, we shot the first short film, and it really became this thing where it pulled everyone that loved David together to work on this project. I don't know, it kind of became this, not just about his work, but about all of us coming together to celebrate him and pay respects to him in that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Can you tell us about this first short film that you're making?
Yeah, the first one is called Isep the Warrior. It was a great shoot. Patrick, our friend Patrick, is playing, Patrick Fugit is playing one of the main characters, and then David's brother, Scott Fetzer, playing the other one. And we shot it in Victoria, Texas, because we were invited to a film festival there, and the director of the film festival, Anthony Bedoni, is just this awesome guy, and he, you know, kind of heard about what was going on, and he had a similar experience, and so I think he really felt the need to help us with this project, and so he, you know, put up all of the gear for us to use, and really helped as far as like bringing that community forward to help us as well. And also, you know, he pulled in some other filmmakers and stuff from the festival to be in the film, and other actors, I guess. So yeah, it was a really, really good experience so far.
When and where will you be screening this?
We'll screen it, this one, and the next one we'll shoot, and if a third if we can fit it in, but screening those in Salt Lake City at the Tower for the 1 year anniversary in December. So this upcoming December, and it will also be the launch of the David Ross Fetzer Foundation, which David's mother is starting, which will be an arts foundation that will give grants to, you know, playwrights and filmmakers, and hopefully expand to musicians and visual artists, since David was kind of all of those things.
I know with your Kickstarter campaign, this recent one, you raised over $18,000 in 1 month.
Yeah, I think something. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, that's amazing that so many people were willing to fund this project that you care so much about. And were you surprised at how much money you were able to raise?
Yeah, I mean, now that it's done, it all makes sense. But when I launched it, it was definitely a little, you know, worrisome. Because you just never know if you're going to, you know, reach your goal or not. And with Kickstarter, if you don't reach your goal, you don't get anything. So, you know, it's always a little nerve-wracking to get into it. But then the more and more people that reached out to me and donated money and, you know, just wrote me these really amazing personal emails and everything like that, it became clear that this project was going to be very important.
How many of David's films are you planning to make? I know you have said that there's at least three that are in the works.
Yeah, I think with this first initial Kickstarter money, I think we can get three of them done, and then after that, you know, I want to still keep making them. There might be a period of maybe, I don't know how long in between, but, you know, enough time for me to scrounge up the money to keep making them, but I'd like to continue doing them, I don't know how often, but as often as I can.
You're close friends with many of the people that you've cast as actors, including David and Patrick Fugit. How did you all meet?
I met David through Patrick. I met Pat through mutual friends and through skateboarding when he returned to Salt Lake City after doing Almost Famous. You know, he, you know, Almost Famous is a big deal. It's a Cameron Crowe film and all of that stuff. But
yeah,
for all of us, you know, the only thing we needed to know about it was that Jason Lee was in it, and, you know, Jason Lee is pro skateboarder and kind of a skateboarding legend. And so we were all super pumped. And, yeah, essentially we just grew up skateboarding together since high school. And then David I met when he was on a break. He went to high school at Interlochen Arts Academy in Michigan. And he was, you know, on a winter break or one of those, and he was in Salt Lake and hanging out with Pat. And then I met him that time, and we hit it off. And then he graduated that next semester. And then I think he stayed in Michigan, though, for maybe an extra year or half year, maybe. Well, anyways, he eventually moved back to Salt Lake, and then we just started hanging out every day and started doing film projects and writing together. And then, you know, we became roommates, and then, I just kind of had this really tight circle of friends where we were just hanging out all day, every day, so that's kind of how David and I became close.
What other projects do you have lined up besides this current one of David's works?
I'm finishing up writing my next feature, which I'll shoot here in Miami. It's a pretty Miami-centric film about a Cuban strongman. I think it'll have a similar tone to Must Come Down, but I don't know. You know, once you do your first film, you learn a lot of things that you want to do again, and a lot more things about what you don't want to do again. Hopefully it'll be a good little project. We'll see how it turns out, but I'm really excited about it.
For more information on Kenny and his project, as well as his films and his upcoming projects, visit him online at kennyriches.com. As always, thank you for listening to the Soundwaves from the Underground podcast. And for all things Slug Magazine, be sure to fire up slugmag.com. Slug's beer columnist, Mike Riedel, is coming back into the studio next week to talk about the latest local beer news. And we'd like to hear what you want to know about the local beer scene. Give us a shout at soundwaves@slugmag.com or call us on our automated voicemail line, available at 858-233-9324. That line's open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We want to know what you think. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Esther Moronio and Alexander Ortega, as well as myself, Dan Nalen. Executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. Main logo and art design by T-Done and technical design by Kate Colgan. Be sure to fire us up again next week when we'll be talking about the beard and mustache competition at the Piper Down. We'll talk to the good folks from Hive Winery right here in the studio. And Mike Rita will come in and talk about all the great local beer stuff for this summer. Thanks for listening.